Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a new episode of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you every week by the TLS. I'm Thea Lynn Arduzzi, and with me again this week, while Stig Abel has his arms full of baby, as he recently put it, is our arts editor Lucy Dallas. Welcome back.
Thank you.
How are you enjoying the heatwave?
Not really.
Oh.
Not northern climes.
Oh no.
can't really do it.
I mean, it's true that Britain has, I've never seen it looking quite so dry and
parched.
Golden and crispy.
Whereas you're loving it because you can handle it.
I'm in my element.
That's
yeah.
Good. Okay.
Banish that image from your minds for the duration of this podcast, though, please. As on the show this week, we are about to immerse ourselves in the wild and windy Yorkshire moors. To mark 200 years since Emily Bronte's birth on July the 30th, 1818, we're looking back on her life and her most famous work, Wuthering Heights, with a nod or full leotarded lunge to Kate Bush's memorable track, whose anniversary we are also celebrating in this week's issue. We'll end on the story, equally wild, albeit in a completely different way, of Tommy Nutter, the rebel tailor of 1960s Savile Row, who from restrictive working-class origins above a cafe in Edgware, pulled himself up by the force of his playfully contrary imagination. When Emily Bronte died in 1848, at the age of 30, she left behind just one novel, Wuthering Heights, published the year before. Not that anyone but Emily and her family knew it at the time, because a book had appeared under the pseudonym Ellis Bell. A second edition, revised by the more cautious and commercially minded pen of her sister Charlotte, appeared in 1850. Wuthering Heights' tale of raw and all-consuming love and hatred centred on Catherine and Heathcliff needs no recap here. It caused a scandal when it first appeared. The graphic violence, immoral behaviours and general grimness of it all were simply too much for mid-Victorian manners. We know nothing in the range of our fictitious literature which presents such shocking pictures of the worst forms of humanity. There is not a single character which is not utterly hateful or thoroughly contemptible, said one reviewer. Here, all the faults of Jane Eyre, by Charlotte Bronte, are magnified a thousandfold, and the only consolation which we have in reflecting upon it is that it will never be generally read, said another. He could not, of course, have been more wrong. Today, the genius of Emily Bronte is undisputed. In the 1980s, John Sutherland could describe Wuthering Heights as the 20th century's favourite 19th century novel, and I wouldn't be surprised if the same held for the 21st century readers, helped along by the novel's rich afterlife on screen, page, and in the pop charts. Yes, we shall come to that song very soon. We've marked the 200th here at the TLS with an array of pieces, taking us from the novel itself through striking, or as in Blake Morrison's case, failed adaptations, blame Cliff Richard, as well as recent criticism, commemorations, and other creative flights. Thus we bring you, in the studio today, the TLS's Robert Potts, who has just reread the novel and has listened to Kate Bush's track. Oh, how many times, Robert?
Dozens and dozens.
Welcome, Robert.
Hello.
And we're also joined by Jacqueline Banerjee, who has reviewed a clutch of recent criticism, covering various angles of Emily Bronte's life and work, and taking us beyond Wuthering Heights. Jacqueline, hello.
Hello.
Have you, Jacqueline, reread the novel yourself recently?
Not recently, no, I have to admit.
Well, I know you have, Robert, so perhaps let's start with you. Has your appreciation of the novel changed through consecutive rereadings?
It would be hard to say that, because the first time I read it was quite a long time ago, when I was about 19 or 20 years old, and I must have done it as part of studying it. And to come to it completely fresh, I remembered almost nothing about it. I was really, really taken by it. I was tremendously impressed. I enjoyed it immensely. I think the style is interesting, and the structure is very, very strange. All of its strangenesses really pleased me. There was nothing very predictable about it. And I think there's also quite a lot of wit in it, as well as these staggering amounts of unpleasantness and violence. All of it was really unexpected to me, and I enjoyed that immensely.
I reread it relatively recently, probably a few years ago, though. And I remember being much more struck by the force of Heathcliff in and his characterisation in the second part versus the first part. I think when I read it the first time, I was a teenager, probably a bit younger than 19, and I was, you know, probably swept away by the romance of the first part.
Yes. Whereas the second half makes incredibly grim and protracted reading, doesn't it?
It's not much fun, the second half, is it, really? Not that the first half is fun.
As such.
But, yeah, it's much more romantic and...
You find yourself having to balance, and you do simultaneously, the your sense of the woundedness of Heathcliff, the terrible, terrible childhood, and the great unfairness of what's done to him, with the eventually unsustainable revenge that he takes at great length in the second half. And it's so unpleasant, and his behaviour so unreasonable, that you can't bear it. But at the same time, you're still aware of that little boy wounded from the first half.
Mm. I think you have a lot of sympathy for him in the first half. It's built up. You do feel that he has every right to feel that he needs to take revenge on somebody for it, Hindley notably. So you do sympathise with him, and I felt, to looking forward to Michael Stewart's, shall I call it midquel, when he shows Heathcliff in the intervening time, you know, when he disappears from the novel and then comes back as a fine gentleman with a lot of money. I don't know about fine gentleman, but a gentleman nonetheless. If you put in what happens in the meanwhile, you will lose sympathy for him again, whereas if you don't put it in, there's a sense of mystery, and that sense of mystery, I think, helps to somewhat soften what happens later on. So you see the child who's abused, the man who has gone through we don't know what kind of experience, and then the man who erupts as he does in the second part.
And it's Michael Stewart, whose spin-off novel you were just mentioning there, who's the one who poses the question. It's not an especially new question. Are we meant to like these characters? Is that an interesting avenue of a way to explore this work, do you think?
It is, but I don't know if liking is the right word. I think we feel very, very much drawn to Cathy, and also to Heathcliff as a boy as he suffers. And I, for one, I still think that Nellie Dean is meant to be a solid, not perhaps entirely credible narrator, but I can still take to her. So I didn't feel that everybody should be dismissed. Zilla as well. I mean, they're not all hateful creatures. I didn't feel they were all entirely shocking, because I think if you felt like that, you wouldn't. The novel wouldn't be so attractive.
But is one of the arguments not that it's so compelling because Bronte's aim was to face us with our own kind of unlikability? Perhaps not the right word, but our own most...
Yes, but if it was all totally negative, then I don't think we would read it. Of course, they've got the nature, the moors. If it was all dark... What do you think? If it was all dark, would you?
No,
want
I agree. I think there has to be something that draws you in, and what does draw you in the first half is so, it's so strange and it's so compelling, and I still think it's very difficult to say why.
Mm.
Really,
I think in fact that was one of the criticisms of Andrea Arnold's film of Wuthering Heights a few years ago, was that it was sort of too dark, it was too grim, and there was none of there was an aesthetic beauty, of course, in her filmmaking, but there wasn't enough of the other that we get.
I thought the first part was wonderful. I enjoyed it very much, with Heathcliff as a sort of lurking in the shadows, always watching. I thought that was very well done, except rather difficult to watch because it's so dark. But I wasn't so convinced by the second part, where they had an older Heathcliff and Cathy. I think that was fairly general opinion that they weren't very well matched.
Yeah. Well, and talking then of darkness, as is pretty much always the case, the novel is read as a key to the author herself. So part of what's so attractive about Emily Bronte's character is how little we know about it, how much remains in the dark, so to speak. The same word that is often used to describe her novel, Strange, seems often to become fixed to her.
Yes, Diana Birch still says it's still strange, it's still baffling, and of course it's true. But there are many ways in which it wasn't as dark as it's made out to be. It was by Mrs. Gaskell, for instance, because you see from later work, from about Juliet Barker onwards, that the childhood was much happier than it was thought to be. And, of course, much richer in resources, in cultural resources, than we've thought. You know, her father went to St. John's, Cambridge, and had a wonderful library, and was interested in, loved music. Mm. They had a lot of facilities there that we don't necessarily expect them to have had. And her childhood was not as miserable as it has been thought to have been.
And a couple of the books that you review for us this week, they sort of focus on the life. What new inflections do we get here? The disagreement over what kind of person Emily was continues, but perhaps you could start us off with Claire O'Callaghan's book, Emily Bronte Reappraised. What do we get there?
Yes. Okay, it's very difficult, but I think Claire O'Callaghan has made her out as relevant to the modern age by painting her as, well, a lover of nature. That is something very appealing to us, of course, with our environmental concerns. That's fine. But as a gutsy proto-feminist, I don't know, but I think part of that is so that we don't give precedence to Jane Eyre, which is much loved by feminists as a proto-feminist novel. I don't see Emily Bronte herself as I see her as gutsy, because I think it took a lot of courage to do some of the things that she did, and she wasn't by nature suited to, like going to Brussels, for example, with her sister. It was difficult for her, and she did it, and she stayed as long as she had to.
And how about Nick Holland? Because he takes perhaps a more interesting route into who Emily Bronte was. He views her life through the prism of her poetry. How does that work?
I think that works very well, actually. I like his work. He's soaked in Bronteana, really. Bronteana in the sense of Bronte history, you know, family history. He knows all about the different members of the family. He brings them all in. And at first, I thought it a little disconcerting when there's a long piece about Aunt Branwell and so on. But in the end, it builds up a very nice picture. And he relates the poems to it very well. One I picked out about, No Coward Soul Is Mine, those poems allow him to talk about her religion, the possibility that she was a mystic or not a mystic in the strange sense, but in the sense of having some inspirations which he felt came from within, not visitations from outside, but inspiration from within. So he uses the poems very well, I think.
There was a couple of poems she wrote when she was working in a school in Halifax.
Yes.
And she was kind of longing to get out of there, which I could identify with a little bit because I was brought up in Halifax.
Oh, were you?
Yes. Though I wasn't always longing to get out of there, but I found it. But actually, they're very moving because she's not far away. She's teaching in Halifax, and she's incredibly homesick for Haworth, which now is, 20 minutes away across the top of the moor. It's not far. Yeah, it's really, it's not far at all.
Oh.
And actually, I know the bit where the school was, that's also up very high.
Oh.
And it's nearly up on the moors. And, it's reasonably similar kind of terrain. It's rather kind of dark and it's quite Wuthery, to be honest. But, I just, for want of a better word. But I thought that was very moving. She wasn't just kind of generally in love with nature. It was her patch, her hearth.
Yes,
and as
yes.
you say, that the life in the vicarage is often portrayed as a kind of awful and they were all cramped and everybody just sort of died one after another, which is true. But as you say, it was very rich. It must have been very rich because they were constantly writing things lots of music. As you say, there's another book where you talk about how much music there was. And actually, they were very cultured, lively, creative family.
I mean, it's amazing. I was surprised to know that there was a Howard Philharmonic Society, you know.
Well, well, there's a very strong musical tradition around there, and a lot of it is from brass bands and, and also from
the
Methodist Church.
Bands, but there was much more than that.
I think there's a natural segue here to the role of music in Emily Bronte's own writing. So let's unleash the moment we've all been waiting for, please.
Oh, yes, please.
Robert, the floor is yours. First off, how did this come about?
Well, Bush had been writing a number of songs in her teens, and this one was inspired not by her reading of the book in the first instance, by her accidentally snatching 10 minutes of the repeat of a 1960s TV miniseries. But it was enough to send her to the book, and Kate Bush realised that she was born on the same day as Emily Bronte, and that she had been known as Cathy throughout her own childhood. And as she said later, when Emily Bronte wrote the book, she was in the terminal stages of consumption, and I had a bad cold when I wrote the song.
I'm glad it was only that.
So there's something destined about it. I think it's very lucky the music company wanted her to debut with James and the Cold Gun, which is kind of honky-tonk kind of thing about a Western cowboys sort of song. Very jolly, but it doesn't really capture the essence of Bush. And she said no, Wuthering Heights, she really pressed for it. And then the second piece of good luck was she didn't like the art on the photograph on the single cover, so the release was delayed until the beginning of 1978, meaning that she didn't have to go head-to-head with Mull of Kintyre.
Oh, you don't want to go head-to-head with Mull of Kintyre.
And
that's
giving
two,
us a,
two versions of nature.
Giving us a double anniversary as
double
well.
Double anniversary, yes.
Yeah.
So that would have been 160 years after Emily Bronte's birth.
And Bush herself, 140, so it's all very, very neat. The whole thing is very beautiful. So, yes, that was the inspiration.
As a debut single, I mean, the strangeness of it seems particularly fitting. I think her vocals, you say, were compared to the wailing of a pregnant cat.
A newly neutered cat.
Very, cat. I mean, I wonder whether a hanging puppy would have been.
Can I just say, wasn't you that said that, was it?
No,
it was
no.
Good.
I
think
you'll find
I was about 10 years old at the time. So,
You get over the strangeness of it, though, don't you? And you watch it, it's beautiful.
It's absolutely perfect for... everything seems to come together, the dancing, the
See, that's
operatic.
The quality that's what I'm saying about Wuthering Heights. There is beauty in it as well, intensity and beauty, and not just the cruelty that seems to be picked out a lot. Am I right that there's a sort of resurgence of interest in horror at the moment?
There's a kind of creative reworking of it.
Depends on your character, I suppose, or your personality. I like to see the other things as well. I particularly feel that the book is beautifully constructed, beautifully balanced. And if you take out the years when Heathcliff's away and build them into another story in the middle, it upsets that balance.
I completely agree with that.
I think you're right
to make that point, that the absence is crucial. And the other thing is it ends on a very redemptive note, not a sort of crassly romantic one, but Heathcliff's almost exhausted by the end. He can no longer keep taking this extended revenge against people who were only sort of related, really, to his proper target. And he's looking at them, and he keeps on seeing the face of his lover in them. But he's also just he's wrung out, and they are able to reunite over books. I think there's a really crucial role, just as there must have been for Emily and her sisters in their childhood, to books throughout. You start off with an anecdote in Cathy's diary about them, both her and Heathcliff, throwing Joseph's religious books into the dog kennel, vowing, "I hate hated a good book. And the good book really, really cops it throughout Wuthering Heights, whereas other books are absolutely crucial. And it's the fact that Heathcliff is taken away from education.
Yep, yep.
And really, really barred, cruelly.
Barred for him. And doesn't young Cathy at the end, isn't she teaching
Hareton
to read?
She's mocked him, she's revolted him. There comes a point where he has taken the books away to try to learn himself, and she laughs at him, and he returns them to her, and one of them ends up throwing the books into the fire, and they both look a little bit miffed about. And there's a lot of petulance throughout the whole novel. People do things petulantly, and they cut off their own noses to spite their faces. They're willing to do that. It's all scorched earth. But in this case, they burn the books. A little while later, that idiot narrator, Lockwood, he comes back and he says, "What, haven't you even got any books?" And she goes, "No, I don't have anything to read." But eventually, by the end, she is teaching him, and they come together, and it's absolutely beautiful. Books are seen as redemptive in Wuthering Heights.
Yes, absolutely. You need that, don't you? You say that Heathcliff's wrung out. His revenge is wrung out, but not his love.
No.
Yes.
And I suppose on a final note, we're seeing again, there's this, and to bring it back to Kate Bush again, I can't help myself. We learn in this week's paper that she's laid one of a series of stones, and these stones have been engraved by other writers. So that again, it's this coming together over these books. So Jackie Kay, Jeanette Winterson, and Carol Ann Duffy have engraved these stones that lead from across the moors, from the village of Thornton, where I think all of the Brontes were born, to the parsonage at Haworth, where I think most of them died. In fact, Michael Stewart, who we mentioned before, he initiated the project, and he's written about it for us. So I suppose on a final note, who will any of us be making this pilgrimage? I suppose for you, Lucy, it's more of a homecoming.
Not really. I mean, it's not exactly my stomping ground, but Haworth is really lovely, actually. It's really beautiful, and I think it is important. I would like to do it, actually, because the thing that is still there, there's so much, as we're talking about, there's so much generated by the Brontes and now about the Brontes, but the thing that really is still there, at the risk of sounding a bit corny, is the moor, and it's the same, or I should say, the moor. and they are the same, and they're not pretty. You know, that it's freezing,
there's a desolate
and it's very
beauty.
Windy, but they are really beautiful, and it's not only desolate, it's all sorts of things, and they are amazing spaces.
I'm working on my husband so that we can come up and
see
it.
We've
been years ago, but it's so completely changed. But as you say, not the moors, that's what Lucy was saying, not the moors.
Yeah.
That'll be beautiful.
Indeed, and we will have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Robert Potts.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, Jacqueline Banerjee.
Thank you.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Now, from Wuthering Heights to rugged couture, do you know what the Savile Row magic trick is? Or what RB, FS, and even SLABC mean? If you're used to getting bespoke suits from Savile Row, then you might. But for the rest of us, Mika Ross Southall is here to shed some light and to talk about the fascinating story of Tommy Nutter, the rebel tailor of Savile Row, as he's called in a new biography by Lance Richardson. Mika, welcome. Many thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Can you put everyone out of their misery, please, and explain what the Savile Row magic trick is and also what all those acronyms mean?
Well, essentially, the Savile Row magic trick is a tailor being able to create a suit for you that enhances your body into a kind of heightened fantasy of itself. So actually, the Dictionary of English Trades in 1804 explained it as a master tailor being able to not only cut for the handsome and well-shaped, but bestow a good shape where nature has not granted it.
Uh-huh.
So if we go back to those abbreviations that you mentioned, they would be written down by a cutter, as well as a client's measurements, to record the cutter's interpretation of a client's figure or figuration. So RB, as you mentioned, means rounded back. FS means flat seat, i.e. no backside.
Mm-hmm. And so nothing to hang the trousers on, essentially, is what we're saying.
Essentially, yeah. And actually my favourite, SLA BC, means stands like a broken down cab horse.
Is that really? And is that really? That's not just Tommy Nutter.
That's not just Tommy Nutter.
Those are Savile Row expressions.
It's codes that they would use deliberately covert because obviously they would offend clients if they could understand what was going on.
I think they would.
But it was a way of them being able to make the best possible fitting suit for individual clients.
Sounds brilliant. I could do with the Savile
Room. Yeah, let's all get ourselves down there.
not really in that area. But to go back to the beginning, how did Tommy Nutter get to Savile Row in the first place? And what did he kind of do to it when he got there?
Well, it was a difficult and slightly protracted journey for him because he came from a tough working class background. His father was very traditional, patriarchal. He actually managed the cafe that the family lived above on Edgware Road. And he sent Tommy to Willesden Technical College when he was 13 to study bricklaying and plumbing, which were butch things, as Tommy himself called them, that he just wasn't interested in. He loved watching Hollywood musicals, painting his room in bright colours, sunbathing. So this three-year technical college education was not what he wanted. After that, he wanted to go to art school, but again, his father put his foot down and sent him off to train as a clerical assistant at the Ministry of Works. And he was there for a year, but was very bored. He basically was making tea for everyone. And he saw an advert in the Evening Standard newspaper for a job as an errand boy at a tailor's on Savile Row called G. Ward & Co. So he got the job, and he went to work there for 9 years, because it was a long apprenticeship. And then he set up a shop on his own, on Savile Row, and it was totally different from all the rest of the shops on Savile Row. He not only innovated the design of suits, but he innovated the way the shops looked. So his shop, which was basically had an ostentatious window display of ostrich feathers and Egyptian murals to attract attention and appeal to a wider audience, whereas other shops on the street had frosted glass or no windows at all, and they would be demarcated by a bronze nameplate to sort of uphold this elitist and snobbish hush-hush.
Because you kind of knew, you knew what it was. They didn't have to advertise, because if you were a gentleman,
you were in
you
the
knew
know.
The deal, and exactly. you know that I go to X for my suits, whereas Tommy Nutter was going, look at this fabulous stuff.
He wanted to appeal to a whole demographic of people that probably didn't know what Savile Row tailoring was.
And the context for this was ripe, of course, because he opened his shop in 1969.
Yeah.
Right, so and this was right next door to Soho, where everything was changing.
Exactly. There was a whole flourishing gay scene in Soho that Tommy was actually very much a part of. So before he set up his shop, he had this kind of split in personality where he was working under these very prosaic, traditional tailors, but he himself in his out-of-office life was clubbing and rubbing shoulders with famous artists, famous film stars, and he basically grew frustrated with the traditionalism of Savile Row, which was why he decided to set up the shop in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Just going back to his working class origins, this is a kind of pet theory of mine, and I know almost nothing about it, so please do say if it's absolute rubbish. But I wondered if there's a bit of a tradition from a working class tradition becoming tailors and designers, because there are people, I'm trying to think, there was Tommy Nutter, there was Bruce Oldfield, who was quite a while ago, but he famously grew up in a children's home, Barnardo's, and then sort of dressed royalty. And there was Alexander McQueen, and you know, you couldn't read about Alexander McQueen without someone telling you all about his background, and they would then move into these very, very wealthy and privileged circles. Is there a tradition of it, or do we hear about them because they're the exception, do you think?
I think there is a tradition, because tailoring was originally a trade job, and so it would be very normal for people to come from working class backgrounds. And in fact, Tommy's business partner, who was a very talented cutter called Edward Sexton, came also from a working class background. He grew up in Elephant and Castle. And if you actually look on the websites of Savile Row tailors' shops today, they advertise sometimes for apprentices, and they encourage them to apply when they're 16 or 18, because it's such a huge undertaking to learn all these techniques. And Lance Richardson actually says in the book that he kind of compares it to brain surgery. I mean, that's a little far-fetched in my opinion, but
a little bit.
It's that same principle, really. And there are also lots of fashion designers like Paul Smith, Vivienne Westwood, and John Galliano, who come from working class backgrounds.
And in fact, John Galliano trained with Tommy Nutter, didn't he?
Well, he did a work experience placement in the 80s at the Nutter's shop, and one of the things that he took away from that was that he saw the sleeves of jackets hanging in a gentle arc on the hanging rails rather than straight down, which is the usual way because they're cut straight. And he went on to experiment with this, and he came up with his spiral cutting technique, which was one of his signature looks.
Mm-hmm. So you can sort of trace a line directly, a spiral line.
A loopy line. Can I interrupt for a second, because you start your piece, Mika, by acknowledging that Tommy Nutter's first suit was bought from Burton's for £8 in 1959. And so, bear with me, there's a tenuous link between our first segment on the podcast this week about Emily Bronte and this second segment. Mm-hmm. Via my grandfather-in-law would have made that suit that Tommy Nutter bought, because he owned and ran the wool mill, which was situated just a few miles from the Bronte Parsonage.
Oh, yeah, because it was full of mills.
And he supplied all of Burton's suits to him.
So he
felt honour bound to point that out. So he would have made that boxy jacket made of brown worsted with a tapered trouser.
Wow, and
there you go.
He influenced and inspired Tommy Nutter from then on, because that was a suit. The feeling he got from wearing that suit was what actually made him realise how much he loved clothes.
Mm-hmm. And how they could change the way that you projected yourself, the way you felt about yourself, and who you could be.
Mm. Well, thank you to your grandfather-in-law.
I had to point that out, I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry.
If we're going in for family anecdotes, I've also got another one.
We've got an hour and a half. Stay with us.
Actually, my dad has a Tommy Nutter suit.
Does
that he still has, and it's beautifully made. It's a navy blue linen, and he bought it in the Tommy Nutter shop in the 80s.
And wow. Does he still wear it?
Are you trying to say no? Not
really.
It still fits him, but it's of a time. Definitely of a time.
Has it got enormous lapels?
Big lapels, great big shoulder pads.
That was part of his style, though, wasn't it?
I mean,
it,
I know that fashion's always a cycle, but I'm not sure that that has quite come back yet.
That's not quite back in there. But that was one of his things, wasn't it? I was going to ask you later, actually, what was his style? And wasn't that one of his things, great big lapels and big shoulders and a kind of tapering waist? Was that was one of his signature kind of silhouettes, is that right?
Absolutely. That came mostly in the 80s. But before that, he updated classic British suit templates in a way to modernise them. So his signature look was huge lapels, which were sometimes so wide that they would brush the shoulders, and tight-fitting trousers, which had enough flexibility so that you could dance, because he was making these suits in a way that he wanted to wear them, and he loved dancing.
For the people in Soho.
Exactly.
I was going to say, it's all very kind of swinging 60s and 70s, and it's very groovy, and he was backed by Peter Brown, who worked with Brian Epstein, and also by Cilla Black, and who, there's a brilliant list of the people he dressed.
He dressed everyone who was anyone, really. I mean, he created Mick Jagger's O'Donnell three-piece suit for his wedding to Bianca Jagger in the 70s, and actually created quite a few suits for Bianca Jagger herself.
Mm-hmm.
He also styled Elton John, the Beatles, for their famous Abbey Road album cover.
Yes, I read about that. Three out of four.
Three.
Of them,
so
yeah.
John, Paul, and Ringo all coincidentally turned up to shoot this album cover wearing Tommy Nutter suits, and they didn't plan that.
They just had, those are the suits they had. Whereas George
wasn't interested.
George is wearing, I was talking about this with another editor at work, George is wearing double denim, in fact.
Oh,
it's a difficult look to pull off, but George
does
it.
He does.
And there were lots of artists like David Hockney and Twiggy. And he actually also created the Joker costumes for Jack Nicholson in the Tim Burton Batman films in the 80s.
I heard about that, because he said that nobody else could do the frock coat, is that right? That
exactly.
They weren't able to do it, they just didn't have the kind of
technique.
Yeah,
whereas that
did.
Was Tommy's trade, and also the wide shoulders.
Yeah, and so his designs went far and wide, but he drew his inspiration from equally as wide a source, or an array of sources, didn't he? Because you mention Jaws, the Falklands War, I mean, these are quite unlikely things for, I would have thought, for a tailor to draw inspiration from.
Absolutely, I think he just had a lot of fun.
Sounds like it.
And sort of pushed what he could get away with. I think that he was this charismatic, beautiful, statuesque figure that people wanted to spend time with, wanted to emulate. And so he created these designs under his label and his brand. He effectively created a brand that people wanted to buy.
Mm-hmm. And it's obviously, as you say, still going strong. Also, some of the suits are still going strong in your dad's wardrobe. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. But I did want to say, because your piece, and in fact the book you reviewed, end on what you call an endearing revelation, which it very much is, when Tommy Nutter told an interviewer what it was that made him happiest. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, it's a very funny and unexpected moment coming from this man who's a seeming extrovert, in that he says that what makes him happiest is not working or socialising, but watching Coronation Street. And he quotes John Betjeman, who said, "It's a half hour of sheer bliss."
There you go. That's the TLS podcast brought to you by Coronation Street. Thank you very much, Mika.
Thank you for having me.
We will have to leave it there for this week. Our thanks go to Mika Ross Southall, Jacqueline Banerjee and Robert Potts for joining us. Take a look at the rest of this week's paper on the website, the-tls.co.uk, or pick up a copy in the shops. Also in this week's issue, you'll find Jo Moran on the problem with employment that is insufficiently rewarding, a look into the world of free climbing, Judith Flanders on the empathetic myth-making of the photographer Dorothea Lange, Michiko Kakutani on issues with truth in modern America, and much more. Next week, Stig will be back in the studio, Lucy and I will be away, and this great game of musical chairs will continue. For now, though, from Lucy and from me, goodbye.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing and context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.